Okay, so we'll just get started. Today we will be discussing the Satipatthana Sutta, the discourse on the establishment or the setting up or the foundation of mindfulness. And this is one of the most loved and best known discourses of the Lord Buddha because it's considered to be a fairly complete and lucid explanation of the practice of Buddhist meditation. And this elusive word that we always translate as mindfulness. Rightly so, because when we look at the Lord Buddha's teaching as a whole, at least in the early forms, in the early traditions, we see that mindfulness or this sort of mind state or this quality of mind which we're translating as mindfulness, we can see that it's very much at the core of the Buddha's teaching. We can think of when the Lord Buddha passed away, right before he passed away, his last words were Appamattena Sampatthita, which means look, O you who see the danger in samsara. All things that arise have to, in the end, cease or pass away. Everything that comes, in the end, has to go. And appamattena sampatthita means to work hard to become perfect in heedfulness or religiosity, religions, which is the opposite of negligence. And so we see that the core of the Buddha's teaching, wherever we look, we'll see that this idea of not being negligent, or this word that I've coined, religions, which basically means having a religious attitude or being of a religious nature, which simply means the opposite of negligence, paying attention and giving life some measure of importance, instead of taking it to be some kind of a game where we can just do and say and think whatever we want, that we have to have some sort of what has come to be known as mindfulness. And that's exactly what is meant by appamatta, not being negligent. The correct explanation of the word appamada is to be mindful at all times. So this is a very important discourse and a very important teaching that the Lord Buddha gave. So if you have time to read through it, you can sort of get a feeling for how it is that one establishes what we call mindfulness. First of all, the word mindfulness, as I've said before, is a fairly poor translation, fairly misleading and vague rendering of the word sati. Sati means to remember, and it's used often to talk about remembering things in the past in the sense of recollecting or thinking over, bringing to mind. It can also be used to talk about the future, thinking about or remembering things that we have to do in the future. Here it simply means to remember reality or remember oneself or remember the experience which one is faced with. The word sati, as we'll see, means the clear remembrance or recognition of something for what it is. And it's brought about by a recalling, calling to mind. Just like memory, when you see something and you remember it to be a person, you remember the color, you recognize some factor about it. Maybe when you recognize that it's something that has caused you suffering in the past, or something that has caused you pleasure, and then it leads to liking or disliking of it. But here, what we're talking about is recognizing something for what it is, and as I've said before, not making more of it than it actually is. So when we see, remembering that that is an experience of seeing, When an emotion arises, remembering that that's an emotion, remembering it for what it is, reminding ourselves of the reality of it. This is what it is meant by the word sati. So we're going to use the word mindfulness, but we have to understand that it really means to remember, or to have a sort of a clear awareness and clear recognition of something for what it is. So the sutra starts eva me sutang, which means thus have I heard, or this is what I have heard. And so this is something that has been passed on from generation to generation, that at one time the Blessed One was living in the land of the Kurus at Kamasadhamma, which they have identified as most likely a place in a suburb of New Delhi in India. And so the talk that the Lord Buddha gave starts, this is the only way, O bhikkhus, for the purification of beings, for the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation, for the destruction of suffering and grief, for the reaching the right path, for the attainment of Nibbana, namely the four arousings of mindfulness. And they say that the reason the Lord Buddha gave this talk in the land of the Kurus is because the land of the Kurus, or the people of the Kuru, of this land were a fairly exceptional group of people, and the land was a fairly exceptional place. The weather was always nice, never too hot or too cold. There was no famine, there was no war, there was no political turmoil. It was all in all a fairly nice place to live. And so the people were fairly well-cultured individuals, right? There was not a lot of time spent bickering and worrying about the lower aspects of life. So there was a lot of more higher intellectual and spiritual discussion going on. And once Buddhism reached this place, as the Lord Buddha went again and again to the land of the Kurus to teach, they were able to, as a society, become very mindful and very interested in the Buddha's teaching, very able to apply it on a practical basis, such that not only the monks and the nuns, but also the ordinary people living their everyday lives were able to practice the four foundations of mindfulness. So, and they would ask each other, so what part of the Buddha's teaching are you practicing today? Are you being mindful of your body, the things that you do? Are you being mindful of your speech, mindful of your emotions, and so on? And the story goes that whenever somebody said, oh no, I haven't been mindful, I haven't had any time today, they would scold each other and say, oh, you're like a person who is dead, having lived your life without being mindful, without taking the time, even though they're working, to become aware and to sort of keep the mind present in the here and now. It's like being dead. They would scold each other as being dead. So it was a fairly cultured and high-minded group of people. So this is the reason the Lord Buddha preached many discourses in that area, especially this one, which is, of course, as I've said, a very important teaching. So first of all, the word bhikkhu here is generally used to refer to the monks, and it may very well be that the Lord Buddha was addressing directly the monks. But it's also quite possible, and likely even in this case, that he was talking to the group of practitioners as a whole. Because, of course, just becoming a monk doesn't mean that one will really and truly take to heart the Lord Buddha's teaching and really and truly practice it. And just because one is not a monk doesn't mean one doesn't have the opportunity to practice and to see clearly the truth that the Lord Buddha taught. So here it means one who has seen ikkhati, which means to see ikkha, one who has seen the fear or the danger, as I said, the danger in samsara, payang ikkhati iti bhikkhu. One who sees the danger. So one who has come in their life to see the suffering inherent in existence, to to come to some realization that it's not, life is not just a game where we can do and say and think whatever we want, because it has repercussions, and these repercussions can be devastating. People kill themselves, people have to take medication, people have to go see psychotherapists because they just aren't able to deal with the suffering that which they encounter in their lives. They've been negligent. And so these are people who see the danger of being negligent, the danger of being unmindful. And so this is what that word means. And so here, the Lord Buddha is making a fairly bold claim. He's saying this is the only way. The four foundations of mindfulness, or the four arousings of mindfulness, are the only way to realize these five goals which the Lord Buddha has outlined. And what does it mean to say that something is the only way? Well, in this instance, it's actually explained in some detail in the commentaries. It's something that they were sort of maybe not having difficulty agreeing on, but didn't pinpoint down to having one meaning. So they give it altogether four or five meanings. First of all, the only way means that it is only one way. And many people object to this, thinking that there are many ways that you can practice and many, all these paths that lead to the same goal, and everyone wants to think that there are many ways to reach the same goal, because of course we see in the world that there are many different practices. But here we're not talking about any particular tradition or school of Buddhism or any particular religion even. What we're talking about again is focusing on reality, putting our attention on reality and seeing it for what it is. And so what the Buddha is saying here is not saying that Buddhism is the only way, or my Buddhism is the only way, or this Buddhism or that Buddhism. What he's saying is the only way to become free from suffering and to attain these five great benefits, these five great goals, is to look and to see reality clearly for what it is. To see things as they are and not become confused and distracted by concepts and delusion. The second meaning is that it's the only way means one, it's the one way meaning that one has to go by oneself. That the practice of meditation is not something that you can learn from somebody else. No one else can enlighten you simply by listening, by studying, or by joining a group, becoming a monk or a nun or so on. Without practicing, it's not of any use at all. It's not something which can bring one to any state of release or freedom. It's the one way, meaning it's the way only of the Buddha, or it's the way of only someone who is a Buddha. So someone who is not a Buddha could not teach this, could not explain it, could not come up with this, because they wouldn't have seen clearly the nature of reality. Because of their confusion and their misunderstandings which still exist in their mind, they wouldn't be able to have the right to be called a Buddha, and because they were not a Buddha, they wouldn't be able to teach this. So it's only a Buddha could teach this. That's another meaning. And finally, it leads to only one goal. It leads to nirvana, or freedom from suffering. So it's not by practicing this path, you don't have to say, maybe it'll lead you in this direction, maybe it'll lead you in that direction. As people who practice meditation can see, the more they practice, the closer they become to freedom, and the more freedom and peace of mind they're able to obtain from the practice. So some people object to the idea that this is the only way, that the practice of mindfulness could be the only way, and any other way is not perfect, is not right. Well, there are many other ways you can construe this to you can translate this word ekayano. You could translate it simply as not leading to any other destination. If you practice this, it's the direct way, or so on. But really, I think it's clear that if you're not being mindful, if you're not being present and alert and attent on reality, then it's not possible by any stretch of the imagination for you to think that you could become you could come to see clearly about reality. You could become free from suffering. Because our sufferings, of course, come directly from a misunderstanding, from a misapprehension of things other than what they are. Okay, so there are five great goals in Buddhism, and this is what the Lord Buddha starts off by saying. He says, through the practice of the four foundations of mindfulness, we can come to overcome, or we come to the purification of our minds, we come to overcome sorrow and lamentation, we're able to destroy suffering and grief, we're able to reach the right path, and we're able to attain nirvana. Now, anyone who's watched some of the videos that I made on YouTube may recognize these as being the basis for my top five reasons why everyone should practice meditation. And I don't mention in those videos where I got them from, but this is directly where they came from. These are not some arbitrary list that I came up with. It's the Buddha's teaching. And these are the top five reasons why everyone should practice meditation. I think these are the greatest reason why anyone should ever have for practicing meditation. First of all, that it purifies the mind, that when we are able to see things and to acknowledge things for what they are and not make more of them than they really are, then our minds become pure. There's no greed, there's no anger, there's no wanting things to be other than they are, and so on. And this is the first great reason why we practice meditation. We're not overwhelmed by our emotions. As a result of that, our sorrow and lamentation is done away with. Any kind of upset, any kind of mental depression or anxiety, worries, fears, are all done away with as a result of having no impurities in the mind. As a result of not getting upset at things, then there is no suffering. So even bodily suffering can be overcome. As we practice meditation, we're able to see through the pain that arises in meditation. So when there's pain, we can see it simply as a sensation and not become upset or distressed by it. This is considered to be the right path, so it means attaining the right path. Once we're living our lives in this way, where we see and understand everything the way it is, then this is considered to be the right way to live one's life, no matter what you're doing. So you can be a monk or not a monk, a nun or not a nun, you can be Buddhist or not a Buddhist, but if you're living your life alert and aware, this is considered to be the right path. And finally, the attainment of nirvana, which simply means freedom from suffering, which is being totally free from any sort of stress or suffering at all. And that is kind of like a supreme state. So it's not just saying, oh, now I don't have any pain in my back, so now that's nirvana. It's a supreme state where there is absolutely no more suffering ever again. It's kind of like the end goal, and it's fine if that's not easy to understand, because it shouldn't be. It's something that takes time and effort and through the practices to be realized. So what are the four arousings of mindfulness? The four are the body, the feelings, and here by feelings we simply mean physical sensations, and the mind, and then dhammas. Here dhamma is translated as mental objects. Actually, mental object is a very poor translation in this case. What it really means is teachings. Dhamma here is the teachings of the Lord Buddha, various teachings, various groups of things that the Lord Buddha has taught, various important groups of realities or mind states or even physical phenomenon that we have to keep in mind. And we'll get to that next week. This week I'm going to try to just skim through the body. So these four foundations are considered to be a good basis of reality. If we want to understand what is reality, these four foundations sort of put it all together. And there's nothing that we will encounter in meditation that we can't put under one of these categories. The first three are pretty obvious. We have the body, and that's the physical. We have sensations of pain and happiness and equanimity. And then there's the mind, which is thinking. Dhammas just means everything else. It's got emotions in there. There's the senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking. There's even the Eightfold Noble Path is in there. So these are things which are, the Dhammas are just sort of a miscellany of things which are going to be useful and going to come into play during the meditation that is sort of going to lead us up and onward in the practice. And there's something that often teachers will bring up slowly as the meditator progresses. And in the beginning, we can focus on the fourth one as being emotions, because in the very beginning, that's all that becomes readily apparent to the meditator. So we understand it to be negative emotions like liking, anger, frustration, boredom, sadness, wanting, drowsiness, distraction, doubt. So these are states of mind. And so we can look at this as mental objects, at least in the beginning, or mind states. We can understand it to be in the beginning. Okay, and what do? We contemplate the body in the body. This is number one. Contemplating the body in the body. What does this mean? It's simply a Pali colloquialism. It's a way of saying that in regards to the body, we focus on the body. Or when focusing on the body, we focus specifically on the body. If we're going to look at the body, then we don't mix it with the feelings. We separate the four out. So in regards to the body, we look at the body. When we're using the body as our meditation object, we're focusing on the body. That's all this means. And it can be quite confusing and people don't understand. In fact, there are some schools of meditation that have actually taken this to mean that inside of this body, there is another body, and inside of that body there is another body, and they go deeper and deeper and deeper trying to find these bodies inside of bodies, and they go, you can find this on the internet, it's kind of a humorous understanding of what it means by body in the body when it's just a Pali grammatical structure, which of course is the way it would have to be. Pali is a much different language than English, and the way it constructs itself is different, and that's all. It doesn't mean anything spiritual at all. It just means we separate the four out. For instance, when we're walking, have you ever seen people do walking meditation? What they do is they focus on their feet. As the foot is moving, you're focusing only on the foot. You're not focusing on your thoughts, you're not focusing on feelings, you're focusing on a part of the body. So in regards to the whole body, you pick a piece of the body and you focus on that. And when the foot moves, they say, step being right, and when the left foot moves, step being left, or so on. When lifting the foot, they say lifting. When placing the foot, they say placing, and so on. Using the body as a meditation object. Normally when we're sitting meditation, we focus on the abdomen. When the stomach rises, we say to ourselves, rising. When the stomach falls, we say falling. Just focusing on a piece of the body, because when you're sitting, there's not much movement going on. And the same with the feelings, the same with the mind, the same with the dhammas or the mental mind states or so on. And then there's this phrase, having overcome in this world covetousness and grief. And there's a lot of argument over the truth of the translation of this one. It most likely means for the purpose of overcoming covetousness and grief. And the argument goes thus, that if it were to mean having overcome, then the point of meditating would have already been accomplished. Why are you sitting and meditating when you've already overcome covetousness and grief, or liking and disliking, all kinds of mental defilements, all kinds of anger and depression, all kinds of suffering states? If they've already been overcome, then why are you practicing mindfulness, since that is the goal, as we talked about above? And the word vinaya could mean either way. It could either mean having overcome, or it could mean for the purpose of overcoming. And the general agreement is that this is a poor translation. It should mean for the purpose of overcoming. But you could look at it as having given up one's attachments to the world. It means gone off and just said, enough. I no longer want to get involved in the world. I'm going to try to give this up. And so in a sense, you have given up or gone beyond your worldly cares, at least for a time. So you can look at it either way, but I think it is quite proper to say that no, you haven't given these things up, but this is what our purpose is. And this is a very important purpose in the practicing of meditation, that when we practice, we should try to give up our likes and dislikes, our attachments and aversions.